So let's start with tolerance. So Prabhupada famously talks about tolerance in the Krishna book. One's greatness is estimated by one's ability to tolerate provoking situations. So now I'll try to unpack the statement in a few ways. So one practical way it means is, tolerance means to call off our war with reality. Our war with reality means that there is a particular situation that has come in our life, and that situation itself is unavoidable. And then if I'm going to resent the situation, I'm going to seethe about the situation, I'm going to wave my fists at the heaven, whatever, none of that is going to change the reality that the situation is there right now. So say for example, say I have to go here from here to Gainesville. And somehow I have to go for a program. I take a wrong turn. And instead of Gainesville, I end up somewhere 20 miles away. Now, the reality is that I'm at a wrong place. If I just get angry with the reality, I can't do anything to rectify the reality. At least I have to accept, okay, I'm at the wrong place right now. Afterwards, I can make the necessary changes to come to the right place. But whatever is the reality right now, if I keep resenting it, then I waste a lot of my energy in that. So for example, if we are in a particular situation or a particular relationship where the other person is, say, disagreeable or irritable or whatever. Now the reality is, I'm in that situation right now. Now I can do things to improve it, I can do things to change things, but first is, this is the reality that I am in right now. And once we call off our war with reality, that helps us to focus our energies. So a related point is, when we are in a war with reality, that means we are resenting the reality. Why is this person acting like this? Why did this happen like this? Why? When we are resenting reality, quite often resentment of reality hurts more than reality. Resentment of reality hurts more than reality. So for example, say we were to go for a yatra somewhere, and we have been looking forward to it, and then just before the yatra, say I get a flu and I fall sick. Now my whole plan for going for the yatra has to be abandoned. Now if I consider the flu itself, yes, there is trouble because of that. But it's basically some weakness is there and I have to just lie on the bed. The flu itself does not cause so much pain. There's just weakness is there and I have to rest. But then in the mind, why did this happen? Why couldn't I go? Oh, all my friends have gone. Everybody is enjoying and I'm lying over here. So all that mental beating oneself up, now that hurts much more than the flu. So this resentment of reality often hurts more than reality. So, another example is that, say, if there's a porter and the porter is being hired and he is lifting up, say, 20 kg weight. And then he'll be paid to lift up 20 kg. But if that porter puts up 10 more kgs or 20 more kgs, then they're not going to be paid for 40 kg. They're going to be paid for 20 kg only while lift up 40 kg. So what happens when we resent a problem? The problem is like 20 kg and our resentment is like 20 kg more. So it becomes a double burden. And then we hurt ourselves more. So tolerance means it's a provoking situation out there. Oh, that one person has behaved in a particular way, or something has gone wrong, or even I have done something wrong. It's a provoking situation. But if I get provoked, I make the situation worse. So once I accept, okay, this is what has happened, now let me see how to deal with it. So now, tolerance is not passivity. It is not that anybody can do anything to me and I'm like a wet blanket, cloth rag which anybody tramples. That is not tolerance. Tolerance is not passivity, but it is the ability to keep small things small and focus on big things. To keep small things small and focus on big things. So for example, now in the Bhagavad Gita, there's a famous verse, about tolerance, that is 2.14. Matra sparshastu kaunteya shitoshna sukhadukkataha agama apayino ityas tam stitikshasva bharata. O Arjuna, tolerate tam stitikshasva. Tolerate the pleasures and pains which come just as summer and winter comes. We tolerate it like that, tolerate this. Now, at the same time, the same Bhagavad Gita in 11.33 also tells Arjuna, arise and fight. Tasmat muttishtha yasho labhasva jitva shatrun bhungshvarajyam samruddham mayai vaite nihata purvameva nimitta matram bhava sarvesachi. So, Krishna is telling, arise and fight. And we look at the whole context of the Mahabharata. He's fighting because in the Kauravas have done atrocities to you. Kauravas have dishonored your wife. Kauravas have stolen your kingdom. Kauravas are adharmic rulers. And you have to take action against them. So, when it comes to dealing with the Kauravas, Krishna is not telling Arjuna, Tam Stitikshaso Bharata. Just tolerate what I have done. So, that means tolerance is not passivity. That anything and everything that is happening, we are simply meant to passively accept it all. No, in this case, Krishna is telling Arjuna that that's a very big adharma that is done, and as a kshatriya, you have to counter it. Then, what is it that he is told to tolerate? Yes, while fighting in the cause of dharma, if you have to fight against your relatives, you have to fight against your teacher, fight against your grandsire, that is distressing. But that is what your duty requires, tolerate it. So, as compared to the cause of dharma, this is a small thing. So, tolerance means it is not passivity. It is not that everything that anyone is doing, I simply have to accept it. But there are, in a relative context, there are things which are small and there are things which are big. And if we don't have this well-developed tolerance muscle, then we let small things provoke us in a very big way. And when small things provoke us, then our energy goes too much into that. Now suppose, we come to a meeting and then we are there for some purpose, and then somebody, they snub us. Now that snub may happen within 15 seconds. But then, next 6 hours, I'm thinking of revenge fantasies. Next time in public, I'll snub them. So what is happening? That event has happened. Okay, now actually it may not even be a snub. They might just be busy and not have noticed us. Or even if it is a snub, now, there is no need for me to seethe over it for hours and hours. It's a small thing. Maybe I can clarify it. Maybe I have to do something about it. But all that is, if I have come for an important meeting where there are many things to be discussed and finalized, and I am burning behind because of that one snub, then the small thing has prevented me from focusing on the big thing. So tolerance helps us to keep small things small so that we can focus on big things. This is, if we let everything that happens matter, we don't let what matters happen. If everything that matters, everything that happens, if we take it all very seriously, every small thing we start taking very seriously, then our mental energy gets consumed by all those small things. And then when the really important things that are there, we can't do them. So tolerance in that sense is when it is not a passivity at all. It is the capacity to focus, to have a sense of perspective. What is more important, what is less important, and to keep small things small. So, if you see Srila Prabhupada, he tolerated so much when he came to the West. The devotees over here, the young hippies over here, they did not know how to properly deal with a sannyasi, how to respect a sannyasi. But Prabhupada tolerated all. Now, if we see when Sumati Moraji, she was Prabhupada's patron, who gave him a ticket to come across to America on the Jaladuta. Initially, when Prabhupada insisted that, give me passage on the Jaladuta, she told Prabhupada, if you want to speak Bhagavatam, you come to my house. Every day I will hear Bhagavatam from you. So, Prabhupada was not interested in that kind of simple ritual recitation of the Bhagavatam. He wanted people to transform their lives by hearing the Bhagavatam. So for Prabhupada, tolerance didn't mean, okay, everybody is just living materialistically, people don't care for Krishna, so I'll tolerate it. Not like that. He wanted to make a change. He wanted to go around and find people who would be seriously interested in him. So certainly, nobody can call Prabhupada as passive. He was very, very active, even at a very advanced age. But while he was being active, at that time, there were many irritants that came up. and he tolerated them. So we keep small things small so that we can focus on big things. And that capacity is developed by tolerance. Now, taroharapi sahishnuna, especially when we are chanting, quite often the mind starts thinking about, basically the mind, when we chant, it just searches for excuses to not think about Krishna. Just searches. And then we, 15 years ago, that person had taken $5 from me. Did not return to me. Now 15 years I didn't remember that, and then I was chanting, I remember that. And then I started, why? I have to get those $5 back. Well, it is like so small things the mind brings up, and then it makes them big. So this tolerance enables us to keep things small. Okay, everything in this world is not going to go according to my plan. So usually what happens with respect to tolerance, we sometimes try to plan our life very systematically. Morning I'll do this, afternoon I'll do this, evening I'll do this, night I'll do this. And then when we try to micro plan our life, then we find that life comes in the way. That means, so this somebody comes and calls, that this goes wrong, that goes wrong. And quite often, when we find that our plans don't work, we just go to the other extreme. We say, I won't plan only. So often we, now to some extent our profession, our job, there is some amount of structure that comes in our life. But apart from that, especially in our sadhana, either we go to one extreme where we want to plan everything in a very micro way, or otherwise we say, just, okay, every day I will read for 1 hour. But then we find it not possible, then, okay, whenever I'll get time, I'll read. And whenever I get time, it means practically I never get time. It becomes like that. So now tolerance, what would it mean? Tolerance here doesn't mean that, okay, if I don't get time, what can I do? I will not read only. No. In general, plans may not work, but planning works. What is the difference? Plans means specific. Okay, I'll do this, I'll do this, I'll do this, I'll do this. But planning means it's basically an overall sense of direction. That this is the way in which I want to move forward in my life. So if I decide that, okay, every day I want to read 1 hour Bhagavatam. But then so many things keep coming. So 1 hour I may not be able to read every day, but I can make it, in a week I can read 7 hours. Or in a month I can read a particular amount of time, whatever is 30 hours or whatever. So sometimes we may be able to read more, sometimes we may be able to read less, sometimes we may not be able to read at all. That's all fine. Just like if we are traveling in a particular direction, if there's a lot of traffic, we'll go slowly. If the traffic is less, we'll move fast. So like that, in our spiritual life, when we're moving towards Krishna, sometimes the traffic of our other activities in our life, that becomes high. And that time, we just have to slow down. Just because slow down, that doesn't mean we have to stop. So the way, if we don't have tolerance, it can work out in both ways. That if I don't have time for my spiritual life, then I get frustrated. Oh, I have so many things to do. I don't get time for my spiritual life. And then the same mind which makes us half-hearted, oh, I have to do this also, I have to do this also, I have to do this also. It makes us half-hearted and disenthused about whatever material responsibilities we have to do. Once we give into that that mind's tendency to resent, my job has so much work to do, I have so many family responsibilities, this, that. Once we start letting the mind go off track, then the same mind which distracted us from our material responsibilities by making us think about Krishna. Making us think, I can't do this, I can't read, I can't go to the temple, I can't do that. That same mind, what it does, once the mind, we let it become uncontrolled, when we are actually doing devotional activities, it makes us think of material things. Chanting, you have that work to do, you have to do that. When will you do that? When will you do that? So that way, the mind neither allows us to do material things properly, nor allows us to do spiritual things properly. So tolerance means, okay, right now I'm in a situation where my worldly responsibilities are more. Fine. I'll accept it, I'll do those responsibilities. And then eventually, if at that time I'm at one level, we always long for wanting to do more and more for Krishna. But that longing is positive, whereas resentment is negative. In longing, the focus is on Krishna. Oh, when can I go to temple? When can I study Bhagavatam? When can I do some seva? Whereas in resentment, the focus is on, why do I have to do this? Why is this taking so much time? Why? So when we are resenting, we are not Krishna conscious. When we are longing, we are Krishna conscious. So longing to have the time to serve Krishna more, that is wonderful. But resenting is actually quite unfavorable to bhakti. And we see Srila Prabhupada himself exhibited so much patience. In 1922, Prabhupada received the instruction to preach and actually was able to focus full time on preaching only 1958 roughly. So it took him how much for 36 years. So he was trying to do whatever he could during those years also. But he was doing his material responsibilities and he was doing whatever he could. And then eventually when he had the opportunity, he focused entirely on Krishna. So this resentment is the, in one sense, the opposite of tolerance. So normally, we may think of tolerance, the opposite of it is aggressive behavior. But that is a different conception of tolerance. When we are talking about tolerance here means, that okay, I accept reality, this is what it is. And rather than resenting reality, I accept it and then I try to move forwards. Okay, I'll do this. Now this is what I have to do more. Okay, this is fine. I accept it, I move forward, and then eventually when things change, I will do more of my devotional activities. So in one sense, when we usually use the word tolerating, there is the negative connotation that I don't really like this, but I have to tolerate this. So that's where we use the word tolerance, which is, yes, there may be some things in our life which may not so likable also. But the principle is that in every situation, we can actually continue serving Krishna. How is that? At the very least, if I'm in a situation which I don't like, then if I can still push myself to do as well as I can in that situation, through that, I am developing an ethos of discipline. I'm developing an ethos of self-control. And that will help me later in my spiritual life also. I do some outreach to college students. So many times when students, when exams come, suddenly they will develop some love for Ramayana, Mahabharata, Leelamrita. All studies, they are all mundane. Ultimately, if we have to become a devotee, why should I study? That love for Ramayana and Mahabharata doesn't come throughout the semester. It comes just before the exams, when the preparatory leave is there. Because the mind simply wants an escape way. And that love is also not for philosophical books. It is for some pastimes. So what is happening? It is not really attraction to Krishna. It can be, but it is basically the mind wanting an easy way out. The mind wanting a shortcut to avoid difficult things. And Krishna says this kind of renunciation is actually in the mode of passion. In 18.5, 6, 7, he talks about renunciation in three modes. So he says, Dukkhamityeva yat karma kaya klesha vayatyajet sakrutva rajasam tyagam naiva tyaga phalam labhet. So he says, Dukkhamityeva yat karma. In this world there is so much misery. Kaya klesha vayatyajet. In this, my body, my mind, they suffer so much inconvenience. Therefore, I will not do this. He says, Tat tyagam rajasam proktam. This is in Rajoguna. And he says, Naiva tyaga phalam labhet. This will not lead to the phala. Phala is the fruit. The fruit of renunciation is spiritual advancement, spiritual realization. That will not come by that. So, sometimes in our life, we do have to go through situations which are unpalatable. But if we see them, not just as, why am I put in this situation? But okay, this is an unpalatable situation. But by applying myself in this, I can learn mind control. I can learn self-discipline. And that mind control and self-discipline can help me in my practice of bhakti later also. So that way, if we see even the materially distasteful situations that we go through, we can see them as opportunities for spiritual growth. And that way, we can move onwards in our lives. So I'll summarize. And you can have question answers. Talk about tolerance, as Prabhupada says. It means one should be able to endure provoking situations without exploding. So, how do we do that? That is, he says, we call off our war with reality. And I give some examples. Say if I have gone by a wrong road somewhere, then I have to accept that I'm at a wrong place, and then I can start thinking, how can I come to the right place? Otherwise, if I'm just resenting reality, then the resentment of reality hurts more than reality. Your two other examples, that resentment becomes like a porter increasing the weight that they are carrying. That resentment, that we have the problem which is a weight, and the resentment is a further weight on the problem. Or it's like, if I have flu, there's an inconvenience of the flu, but I'm resenting, oh, my plans are upset, that hurts me more. And then discussed about how tolerance is not just passivity. Anybody and anyone can do anything, and I just have to endure it. Krishna tells Arjuna, fight against the Kauravas. So he's not telling tolerance over there. But tolerance means we keep small things small. Yes, while fighting, you may have to fight against your relatives. For the cause of dharma, which is very big, you tolerate that. So keep small things small so that we can focus on big things. And we discussed how Srila Prabhupada tolerated when he had his purpose of sharing Krishna's mercy, and for that purpose, whatever inconveniences is got, whatever difficulties that he tolerated that, and he kept preaching. And if we let everything that happens matter, then we don't let what matters happen. We discussed that in our life, sometimes plans don't work because unexpected, untoward things happen. But then we don't have to become frustrated and give up planning itself. Planning will give us a sense of direction. And if you have that direction, sometimes we move faster. Like when the traffic is less, we move faster. Sometimes we move slower. So, but we'll keep moving forward. And even in our material life, if we get some distasteful situations, if we start resenting them, and the mind will develop a habit of basically being absent-minded. So in our when we are doing material responsibilities, it will make us think about spiritual things. And we are doing spiritual things, it will make us think of material things. And we'll become unproductive in both. But if we see even the material distasteful situations as opportunities for developing mind control, for developing self-mastery, then that can help us even in our spiritual life. So any questions, comments? Yeah. Yes, please.
Kirtaniya Sadahari. Kirtan is many different ways besides chanting and doing the devotional service, many different ways, reading. The tendency is not to chant more than 16 rounds. Is that not a canvas?
Okay.
More? Because sometimes okay. Tendency, 16 rounds done, bring back, is that?
Yeah, okay. So, sometimes we have a tendency to not chant more than 16 rounds. So, is that desirable? See, there are two different aspects over here. One is the process of chanting, and the second is the purpose of absorbing ourselves in Krishna. Chanting is the primary means for absorbing ourselves in Krishna. At the same time, that is not the only means. So, in this, there has to be some amount of individuality. I have to find out how I can absorb myself in Krishna the best. And some devotees may find studying Shastra is a very good way to absorb ourselves in Krishna. Some devotees may find deity worship as a way to absorb themselves in Krishna. Some devotees may find preaching as a way to absorb themselves in Krishna. And some devotees may find chanting as a way to absorb themselves in Krishna. So, the important thing is that bhakti, there is austerity in bhakti, but it is not that austerity becomes the only thing in bhakti. So, if we make it that, oh, all serious devotees should chant 64 rounds. But then, not everybody will find that so absorbing. Or we may just be counting, and sometimes what happens if we decide that, oh, I'll chant 64 rounds. And then afterwards we find, I'm not getting any taste in this. Then we chant and chant, and internally, actually we are resenting, why do I have to chant so much? Then that is not Tesham Tatat Yuktanam Bhajatam Priti Purvak. That is not joyfully done bhakti. So, if we feel inspired to chant more, then definitely we should chant more. But it is not that chanting more is the only way to absorb ourselves in Krishna, nor is it that chanting more is the only sign of seriousness. So chanting more is one way in which we can absorb ourselves in Krishna. At the same time, there are different ways. And as far as the tendency to not chant anything more after 16 rounds, yes, there is that tendency because at our stage, we don't get so much taste in chanting. So That's why quite often we feel as if, what is the next thing I can do? I feel the next thing is more important. So that's why, to some extent, you know, while chanting also, or along with chanting, it is good to hear the holy name, hear the glories of the holy name regularly. That gives us some inspiration for absorbing ourselves in chanting. Now, in one of my books, there is a whole article about, I find chanting boring, so what should I do? So I explain many, 3-4 metaphors again, but one metaphor I say is, now suppose somebody goes for weightlifting. And then they have made it a ritual that every day for 1 minute, I'm going for weight training. But then after that, what happens? They find, okay, this lifting this weight is very difficult. And after that, I have to go here. You know, I have to go to this meeting. I have to go to this party. I have to go here. So while they're doing the weightlifting, they're thinking, when will I just finish this and go out? And after some time, they think they're so eager to do the next thing that they go through the motions. They have the dumbbells, but they don't put any weight in the dumbbell only. So all that is happening is his hands are moving up and down. Now, if I just keep the hands moving up and down, that is also exercise, but that is not really exercise. So then I will not get any benefit from that. And then I will feel, why am I spending 1 hour just moving my hands up and down? So when the whole thing begins by, first is, I'm eager to do something next after the weightlifting. Second is, I try to do it as shortcut as possible. And then I stop lifting the weight only. When I stop lifting the weight, then I don't get any benefit from weightlifting. Then I think, why am I doing this at all? So like that, you know, when we are chanting, we are meant to remember Krishna. And if we don't remember Krishna and we are just uttering the holy names, that is like moving the hands up and down without putting any weight on the dumbbell. So then, it doesn't serve much purpose. Certainly, any kind of chanting is good. But when we are not actually connecting with Krishna, then we start feeling, why am I wasting my time like this? And then we may either stop chanting or just rush through the chanting. So what has to be done is, if we hear the glories of the holy name, then we are able to absorb ourselves. Why is this important? Now, it's not just that I had to come 1 hour for doing weightlifting. There's a purpose why I'm chanting. Why I'm doing this exercise. And similarly, if we remind ourselves of the glories of the holy name, then when our consciousness contacts with Krishna while chanting, Sukhena Brahma Samsparsham Atyantam Sukhmashnuti, that when the contact comes, then we feel strengthened, we feel purified, we feel a higher satisfaction, and then we feel inspired to chant. Now, it may not be possible to do this for all 16 rounds. But at least some rounds, we need to make a determination. I'm going to be attentive. And at least that contact will give us conviction. Okay, I don't have the capacity to concentrate attentively on all 16 rounds. But this process has power. And this process purifies, this process gives me strength. And it's worth it. It's like in weightlifting, I have to exert to get the benefit of strength and muscles. Similarly, in chanting, we have to exert to put in concentration, then we get the benefit of purification. So to the extent we do that, to that extent we absorb ourselves in chanting and feel the fruit of chanting in terms of purification and spiritual strength, to that extent we'll become eager to chant more. So without this experience, if we just make it a mandate that I should chant more, often we might just be counting the beads, but we may not be absorbing ourselves. So we have to see individually. Yesterday I talked about Uddipan, you know, what inspires, what is the spiritual stimulus that takes us towards Krishna. So if chanting is the spiritual stimulus that takes us towards Krishna, that's wonderful. If something else is there, we have to find out whatever it is and do that. Any other questions? Yes, we can come back. Yeah. Yes, Jamashu.
You're covering also humility in this question session, right?
Yeah, please. Yeah.
So when you spoke about Amanitvam and Adambitvam. Was that coming from the commentaries of the Acharyas? I've often wondered about that, and that's the first explanation I've heard. How I have some honorable qualities, but I don't create them to get respect. I mean,
yeah.
Amanitvam and Adambitvam. One doesn't have good qualities, but makes a pretense of having them wanting recognition.
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
I think it is from Chakravarti Path, or maybe not Chakravarti Path's commentary. Either it is here or it is in that 16th chapter, Dambho Darpo Abhimanascha Krodha Parushyam Evacha. So there he differentiates between Dambha, Darpa and Abhiman.
What's that reference,
16.4? Either it is here or it is there. I remember reading the difference between Dambha and Mana. So Dambha is basically, it's basically when I make a show to get honor whenever I don't have those qualities. So Mana, that's the difference. I think that is either here or there in 16.4. Any other questions? Yes, Prabhu.
What makes the sun able to apply the higher understanding of the local situations? And would you say, is it helpful to be self-analytical after the situation occurred and we realized we failed the test?
Okay. So, now how can, when the provoking situations come, how can we tolerate it, or is it helpful to analyze after the situation? Yes, both are true. First is that all of us, we can, if we observe ourselves, we will know that we all have certain triggers. There are certain things which just cause us to explode. Now, once we know those things, we can prepare in advance. Like if, say, I suppose in America we don't have that issue. In India, often the roads have potholes. So if I am going on a road in a car, in a vehicle, and I know there is a pothole over here, then in advance itself, okay, I know I have to go on the side. So I prepare. There's a pothole. I prepare to go by the side. So like that, in our life journey also, we can know that there are certain situations where I get provoked. So when we know that this is a situation where I tend to get provoked, we try to plan in advance. What can I do to avoid that? Like I just go around the way. So like that, if say too many people make too many demands from me, then I just snap. Then what should I do? Then, okay, I know these are the time, maybe this is the time of the weekend, or this is the time of the month, or this is the time when too many people are going to come to me. So I plan in advance. Maybe I'll have to say no to some people, but I'll have a plan answer. How I can politely but firmly say no. Otherwise, you know, we say yes, yes, yes to 6, 7, 8 people, and then the 9th person comes. You know, all the resentment of the previous yes, it comes as one violent no. So, if we know that what our triggers are, then we can plan in advance to how I can best deal with this. And overall, it is not that Maya attacks us in very new ways all the time. The situations themselves may be new, but overall the circumstances, if you see, the patterns are similar. So once we know our triggers, then we can put in some thought, how can I deal with this? And that we have to plan in advance. That's the first thing. Second is that we can try to develop something like our own pause button. That means when I feel an impulse to snap at someone or impulse to do something suddenly, and I make a no pause. I'm not necessarily, I won't do this, but not now. Not now. So, you know, I correspond a lot with people by emails. And because I'm a writer, I can play around with words well. But this also works negatively, that if I want to cut someone, I can cut very ruthlessly. So I find that actually, I don't really want to speak like that, but in the heat of the moment, it comes out. So what I decided is that if I'm going to write any strong email to someone, then I made a policy that I'll write that email, but for 24 hours, I will not send the email. So now what happens if I don't write the email? All that resentment is there within me. So it will all be inside me. But once I have written it down, to a large extent, things calm down. Things cool down. Yeah, I vented myself out. But then after 24 hours, and I come back and I look at this, the mental pressure has gone down quite a bit. I look at, yeah, this is a sensible point. No, this is too harsh. This, I really don't know the situation. I'm making a premature judgment here. So you can evaluate it at that time. So that pause button is that just 24 hours, don't do anything about it. Not don't do anything in terms of don't express itself. Express, but don't communicate to that person. So I found that this is a very practical way, because if we don't express at all, then that becomes like a pressure cooker in the heart, which will explode afterwards. So there is some expression that is required, but that expression doesn't have to be a communication. So I get it out of myself, but it doesn't have to reach the other person in that form. And that I find journaling also very helpful. Now, that basically journaling means the same thing. If I'm upset about something, if I'm angry about something, then just get it out. So getting it out is good for me, but getting it to them is not good for them. So I get it somewhere in the middle. And then after that, when we evaluate it again, then you find out, okay, this, as I said again, we can evaluate it calmly. So actually I'm writing a book on the yoga of journaling. So there, the subtitle I gave it is that training our intelligence to become the counselor of our mind. So training our intelligence to become the counselor of our mind. What that means is, first time when I'm angry with someone, I'm provoked by something, I just vent myself out. That time, it is my mind speaking. No, you know, he's like this, she's like that, they are like that. So much thing of resentment is there. And it is there, you know. When we have certain feelings, we cannot wish them away. Those feelings are real things within us. So we express them. And then that at that time, largely it's the mind speaking. So the mind needs some vent, give it some vent by writing down. And after, maybe as I said, 24 hours or something, then I come back and see it again. At that time I have calmed down. Now it is my intelligence reading it out. Okay, I wrote this. And then I make whatever changes are required. And then I communicate to others. So this journaling or writing or expressing but not communicating, that is one way in which I found a pause button helpful for myself. But all of us can have different pause buttons. Now, some of us may find when we get very angry, we just hear some very nice kirtan, or ourselves sing something, or in some cases we may chant extra and just pick up the beads and start chanting. That can also act as a pause button. But again, the point of it is not just the specific activity. It should cause the pause. Other than just chanting, but then I'm thinking, you know, I'm just making plans how I'm going to get back at that person. We have to have something which can just draw us out of that situation. And what that will be, that will vary from person to person. So if we find that and we do that, that pause button in the provoking situation also, we can avoid getting provoked. So it's not that we can, when the feeling of anger is there, when the feeling of frustration is there, that we can't just repress it. We repress it, it will express itself later. We can't repress it, we have to process it. So there is repression, there is expression, and there is processing. So what happens is, if I repress it, it comes up and explodes afterwards. If I express it at that time itself, then also it's trouble, because it's not properly filtered at that time. So if I can process it, then I can actually, that's a medium between expressing as well as repressing. So after processing, when I express, then actually it is in a reasonable way, in an intelligible way, in a way that it gives vent to what I am feeling. At the same time, it doesn't come off as too aggressive or insulting or demeaning for the other person. And then we can take things forward. So we can find out what is a pause button for us. That is the second thing. And third thing is, yes, as you rightly said, after a particular situation happens, then we look back and learn. Okay, in this time, I did this and you know this didn't work. Maybe I should not have done this at this time. So in this also, there are two things. There is learning from the past and there is lamenting about the past. And the two are very different. The difference is primarily in which mode I am situated. When I am in tamoguna, when I think about the past, I simply lament. Oh, you know, why did he speak like that? Why did I speak like that? You know, I am always so uncontrolled. I just keep doing things, same mistake. And I'm just beating myself up. I'm not doing anything constructive by that. So if I'm in tamoguna At that time, thinking about what has gone wrong, that doesn't help in any way. In fact, that only makes the wrong aggravated. So even when we have to look back, it has to be when we are in sattva guna. When we have done some sadhana, studied some shastra, we are in a peaceful frame of mind. Then in sattva guna, we look back, okay, this happened, then this happened. Now probably I could have done this way. Probably I could have done this way. And then we can learn from the past and use it for our future. So that looking, that means the difference, another way of understanding the difference between learning from the past and lamenting about the past is, when we are lamenting, the mind is forcibly taking our thoughts to the past. Whereas when we are learning, we are consciously taking our mind. I'm in control of my mind and I'm taking my mind. Okay, let me think about this situation. Okay, this was what happened. This is how I reacted. But this is how I could have reacted. And we are in control. But when we are lamenting, the mind is in control and it's taking us here, taking us there, taking us there. And essentially, we don't learn much from it. So that way, by knowing what are our triggers and planning in advance to deal with them when they come, by having our own pause button, which enables us to process our emotions, neither repress them nor express them, or express them in unmerited, and by learning from the past, we can actually become more tolerant in provoking situations. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Prabhu. I'll come to you.
There are 4 ways of getting deliverance. There are different means in different ages. So Kali Yuga is said to, that chanting is a way to go. So chanting is a way to go, is it in statistics that mostly it is the way to go, and the means is equally powerful? Or is it that chanting is especially more powerful? Or is it that Lord Krishna is saying that chanting is recommended? So
okay. So when we say chanting is the yuga dharma, is that mean chanting is a recommended process, or chanting is the best process, or is chanting the only process? Yeah. See, chanting is definitely essential. But the whole point is that we have to develop a relationship with Krishna. So chanting is the primary way in which we can develop that relationship. At the same time, it's a relationship. And that's why there are 9 limbs of bhakti. Now, if it was only chanting, then Rupa Goswami didn't have to write a book of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu where he talks about 64 items of devotional service. Because just chant Hare Krishna, everything will happen. You know, Prabhupada, he gave so much philosophy in his books. He could have just chanted. You know, he's given us philosophy. He has given us so much shastric commentary. So, there are 2 extremes. One is that I make chanting only everything and neglect everything else. If I can truly become absorbed in chanting, that's wonderful. But for most of us, it is difficult to be constantly absorbed fully in chanting. So there is no need to reduce the whole process of bhakti only to chanting. Because the process of bhakti is a process of developing a relationship with Krishna. And chanting is important within that. And because it is yuga dharma, we do definitely need to chant. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that is the only thing we need to do. If we can, from the chanting, everything will come. But for most of us, it is difficult to chant constantly. So there are other processes also involved in bhakti. So when it is said that this is yuga dharma, that means this is a vital process. But that doesn't mean that is the only process. By only process means certainly anybody wants to develop bhakti, they have to chant. But along with chanting, there are other ways also in which you can connect with Krishna. Not only does Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu talk about 64 items of bhakti, it also talks about 5 potent forms of devotional service within that. So that way, we see the process of spiritual advancement as a process of developing a relationship with Krishna. And while giving chanting the central primary importance, we also observe to see what are the ways in which I can develop a relationship with Krishna in a sustainable way. Okay? Thank you. Yes, Prabhu.
My question is about humility, Prabhu.
Yeah.
I kind of feel a conflict in personality when it comes to humility. Being in healthcare, if I'm trying to be humble, I sincerely want to be humble and tolerant because I've been hearing about it quite long. But if we be there in work situation, because we have to carry over everywhere, it is not appreciated because people take you for a ride or they make you overwork. In the second situation here, In devotees also, among devotees, sometimes we sincerely try to be humble because I'm not, still not humble yet. And when a service comes and with my limited time and capacity I'm not able to do, I politely say no. It turns again saying that he's pretending. He's not humble as such. So I'm facing this conflict. Could you explain like how to balance or how to be humble?
Yeah. So in our professional life as well as in devotional life, if we try to be humble, then either people take us for a ride, or if we have to say no, then people turn against us. So how do we deal with it? See, first of all, as I said, humility, we may have certain stereotypes of what humility means. And they may not be necessarily the right understanding of humility. So does humility mean that we have to say yes to everyone? Well, basically, it's impossible for us. We are finite human beings. We cannot say yes to everyone. The easiest way to make yourself as miserable is to try to please everyone. So we just can't. We are limited people. So in some cases, we do have to say no. Whether it is devotional life or it is in professional life, whatever it is. So humility is not so much whether I say yes or no. It is more a mood of how I say yes or no. So it is, it's like, you know, then Duryodhana, when Krishna went as Shanti Duta. And Krishna actually was very humble in that situation. And he's God himself, but he's going as an emissary. And then he is so accommodating. He says, just give 5 villages to the Pandavas. Now there are ways of saying no. And Duryodhana was so insolent. What was his reply? He said, I'll not give enough land to even pass the tip of a needle through. Says, you know, this is not just no, this is an arrogant no. In fact, you could say this is the most arrogant way of saying no. So you know, we can say no to a request without saying no to the person. But here the way it is said is, it is not only I am saying no to this particular thing, but I am just rejecting the person itself. So humility means sometimes we have to say no to some people. But we learn the way to do it in a respectful, sensitive way. Maybe explain our situation a little bit. And some people don't understand, then what can we do? I just have to know that we cannot please everyone. So that's with respect to saying no. The principle is that we have to say no. And if we displease someone by that, that's okay. That is something, that's just a part of being human. Our condition is that we are limited beings. And we cannot please everybody. Now, in a professional setting also, if we have this stereotype of humility again, that, you know, anybody says anything, I just accept it, then that is not exactly right. See, again, as I said, humility means to not let our ego interfere with our purpose. So I'll give 2 examples from a professional setting of how humility might work, might be helpful. Now, if somebody is, say, a boss in a company, and there is some subordinate who has come up, and a subordinate has come up with a very good suggestion, and in the meeting, their subordinate gives a suggestion. The boss thinks, "No, I own this company. I have been in this business for 20 years. And this upstart is just 6 months here. And he has the audacity to give a suggestion to me. I just stamp down that person." Well, if that suggestion had been good, if the suggestion were good, I could have benefited from it. So if we say, in a professional setting also, humility means openness to suggestions by others, then that is an advantage. And in team playing, team leader said, you know, listen to others. Now, listening to others itself is in one way humility. We listen doesn't mean we have to accept and do everything that they are saying, but just being open to hear about it. So that way, even in a professional setting, humility can be appreciated. Another thing is that, say, if we work in a team, or suppose there's a cricket match or there's any team sports, and there's one star player, either captain or some star player, and the star player plays the most important role in winning. But then when the credits are offered, you know, when the man of the match or whatever award is given, then the team player may either say, you know, I am such a great player. Or that star player may say, no, actually it's a team effort. And you know, when even in sports, somebody acknowledges it's a team effort, everybody appreciates that. So you know, it's not that humility is anathema in worldly life. It is not something which is always frowned upon. We may have certain stereotypes which may not be applicable. So if we think of humility means not being assertive, then that's not the point. Humility means that, you know, basically I am not absorbed in myself. So I have certain things to do, and while doing those things, if whether I'm honored or dishonored, I don't bother about it. I focus on doing the things. So if again that second part, to not let our ego interfere with our purpose, we consider it that way, then it is, then humility can be practical even in professional life. Does it address your question?
Yeah,
you have a question? Yes.
So, I don't mean to minimize your explanation, but I want to have a clarification. What I understand from Bhaktivinoda Thakur, that on the Vilasita Simnam verse, he explains that there is a three types of devotional. One is Arup Siddha, that my intention is poured in while I am offering. And then Sangha Siddha, that there is some other elements like humility or tolerance, that I will chant to develop those also. And then Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, but we should not focus either one, we should focus on Swarup Siddha, the intrinsic nature of the pure devotional service itself is produce natural genuine love for the Lord, which has a automatically tenderness towards the other living being, Balisheshu. That is natural. And then automatically compassion, when arises, the tolerance is a byproduct. It should not be separately endeavored. But from your explanation, what I'm understanding is that the two types of tolerance. One is for self correction, maybe rectification, how I'm going to handle. And another is perhaps if it is offensive or abusive towards the other person, Lord or some missions and other, how to handle it. Am I correct on that, or should we really develop? Even Bhakti Thakur goes on that Krishna Avinivesh is 28 quality in Bhagavatam, but Krishna Das Kaviraj put 26, and he said Krishna Avinivesh is the intrinsic of all other qualities, where the humility and tolerance is also there, you know, everything. Otherwise, tendency will go like, I want to just chant and develop tolerance.
Okay. Yeah. But the question is that, should we chant purely, simply for pleasing Krishna, for developing a love for Krishna, and from that, all qualities will come automatically, such as humility or tolerance, or should we also make some efforts for developing these qualities separately? Essentially, bhakti, at least the way I understand it, is the most important practical, from the practical perspective, the principle is anukulyasya sankalpa pratikulyasya vachana. Now, I accept what is favorable and I put aside what that which is unfavorable. And interestingly, see, if you see, these two are called as limbs of surrender. So, among the Shadvidha Sharanagati, this is, if there are six things, anukulya sankalpa, pratikulya sevarjanam, rakshishati vishwasa, goptutve varanam, tata atmanikshepa karpanne, Shadvidha Sharanagati. So, it is a protection that Krishna will protect, the confidence that Krishna will protect, and I am dependent on Krishna. So this, like this, there are six elements. Now, significant is that among these six, the next four are emotions, whereas these first two are actions. You could say emotions or dispositions. Yes, Krishna will protect me. Krishna is my maintainer. You know, I am nothing without Krishna. Atmanikshep. Now, all these are dispositions. They cannot come automatically. They will take time to develop. So, it's significant that along with these dispositions in surrender, the definition of surrender also includes practical actions. Anukulyasya sankalpa pratikulyasya vachana. Accepting that which is favorable and putting aside that is unfavorable. This is very, in one sense, if we have the concept of surrender like Draupadi raising her hand and surrendering. Now, this is quite opposite to that. This is quite resourceful. This is quite practical. This is quite active. Okay, is this favorable? I'll accept it. Is this unfavorable? I'll avoid it. So, surrender in that sense is not just passive dependence. Here, surrender is active choosing. I understand, okay, this is favorable, it's not favorable. I actively choose things. So this aspect of surrender is also very important. And it is not just, he's not talking, Bhaktivinoda Thakur elaborates on this also. He's not talking just about some preliminary stage, he's talking about surrender, which is a very advanced stage. So now, in our practical practice of practical bhakti, we have to see how things work. The aspiration is for pure devotion. But at the same time, we have to connect with Krishna. So that means that, I think yesterday I mentioned that, you know, we cannot become pure devotees without becoming devotees. What that means is, okay, I'll give a couple of examples for this. Say, if there is some big problem in my material life, and you know, some huge problem is burdening me, and I think that, you know, oh, I want to practice pure devotional service. So I will not pray to Krishna anything about this. And whatever happens, Krishna knows everything, Krishna will take care of everything. And I'll pray only for I'll pray only to increase my chanting, increase my hearing. And I'll not even mention to Krishna about my material problem. Now, okay, I may think I'm aspiring for pure devotion, but that particular problem is actually occupying a huge place in my consciousness. It is a big burden on my heart. And basically, bhakti is, you know, connect the connection of heart to heart. We want to connect our heart with Krishna. So something which is anyway having a big place in my heart, if I decide that I will not talk about it with Krishna, I will not pray about it to Krishna, then what is going to happen is a large part of my heart will stay disconnected from Krishna. In our present condition stage, the material things do affect our consciousness. If I get some big disease, if I have a major financial problem, if I have big relationship upheaval, these things consume our consciousness. So if my conception of pure devotion is that, you know, I will not talk anything about my material life with Krishna, I will only focus on bhakti, then a large part of that which is in our heart will stay away from Krishna. So if you focus on the point that I have to develop a relationship with Krishna, so if there is something which is burdening my heart, then, you know, I offer that in prayer to Krishna. And then, in this case, the surrender can be that, Krishna, this is what I feel is the solution to the problem, but whatever is the solution, whatever is your will, let thy will be done. You know, please give me the strength to serve you. So just speaking it out, you know, or praying to Krishna about it, that can quite often unburden the heart, and then we can connect better with Krishna. So what I'm saying over here is that pure devotion is our aspiration. But sometimes in trying to stick to the ideal of pure devotion, you know, even devotion doesn't remain in our heart. Because what happens is the material things do take a lot of consciousness of mine. And if I think I'm not going to think about anything material with Krishna, then practically I feel I know nothing to connect with Krishna for me. So the problem, it can be a problem if I am only asking Krishna for material, this problem is there, Krishna solve this, Krishna solve this, Krishna solve this, and I'm not doing any sadhana, I'm not praying for the increase of my bhakti at all. I'm only praying for material things. But so for us in our life, we don't have to, once we have dedicated our life to Krishna, we don't have to make a rigid separation between the material and the spiritual. Because even the material affects the spiritual. So, and even the material can be used in the service of the spiritual. So, we definitely need some time for directly spiritual activities. But even the material activities can be spiritualized. So, that way, this is slightly different from your answer, but I'm giving this as an example to illustrate that sometimes talking to Krishna, or praying to Krishna about material things with a surrender eventually. Whatever is your will, I'll accept it. But this is what I feel. That surrendered mood can come at the end, but we can express our concern to Krishna. And that way we authentically connect with Krishna. Otherwise, it's just ethereal. I'm thinking of pure devotion, but then my whole consciousness is consumed with just practical problems and I don't know how to deal with them. So similarly, rather than seeing this any efforts to develop humility or tolerance as something separate from bhakti, we can see them also as activities which are anukul to bhakti, and we accept them. So that way, if we do it, it is quite helpful. Now, for some of us, we may find that, yes, by chanting, it happens that, okay, all wonderful qualities blossom. But in many cases, it doesn't happen. Sometimes, unfortunately, what happens is, our chanting and our practice of bhakti, it makes us more judgmental instead of more understanding. Now, I follow my standards, I am following strictly, and actually if I am really going spiritually, I should become more empathic towards others. But I become more judgmental towards others. You know, this person is like that, this person is like that, this person is like that. So what is happening is because of our past conditionings, we are not able to chant purely. We are not able to practice bhakti purely. So then we are chanting, but we are more becoming judgmental towards others. You're not really becoming compassionate towards others. So then, because of our conditionings, we may not be able to access pure bhakti right now. So at that time, doing those things which are anukul for the practice of our bhakti, that is fine. Srila Prabhupada would say that one time, I don't remember who now, one of Prabhupada's servants said that one day after they came back from a program, he heard Prabhupada hearing his own lecture. And then he asked Prabhupada, Prabhupada, you are hearing your lecture? Prabhupada says, yes, I was checking what I spoke. I also learn and I improve. So now we must say Prabhupada is a pure devotee. Krishna is speaking through him. Why does Prabhupada have to improve? No, but Prabhupada is also seeing from his perspective, what can I do? So one of my friends has done his PhD in Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur. So he showed me a book. Now that was Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur's English vocabulary book. You know, like the students learn for GRE or SAT, they learn English words. So Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur, he wanted to preach in English. So he was learning English words. He was writing down words and their meanings. So even an acharya may have to do what is required for gaining the skills for serving Krishna. So for Prabhupada also, you know, his father had him train for learning mridanga. So now what happens is, when it comes to relatively grosser skills like this, say learning English or learning mridanga, we understand that it is not just by pure devotion these will come. You know, sometimes somebody may be singing with great devotion, but they may be playing all the mridanga steps wrong. It is not necessary that their pure devotion will automatically manifest as right mridanga beats. So when it comes to things which are little more physical, when things are little more physical, we understand that pure devotion won't automatically develop this. I have to put in some efforts to do this. And we don't say, hey, why are you doing this? No, mridanga learning, that is an activity which is anukul to bhakti, very, very well in bhakti. So we put in the time for learning mridanga. So when it comes to qualities, things become a little hazy. There is the body, there is the mind, and there is the soul. So when something has to be done for the body, we understand it. That this is what is required, I'll have to do it. But when it comes to the mind, does everything at the level of the mind automatically develop by the practice of bhakti? Means say, as tolerance or humility or whatever qualities we are talking about, which are subtler. They can be of the soul, they can be of the mind. I won't go into that right now. But is it that they will develop automatically? They may or they may not if our practice is not pure. But we have to see what is anukul to bhakti. So in some cases, no, if we learn some principles about how to practice tolerance or how to practice forgiveness, how to practice patience, and those can help us in our practice of bhakti, then we see that as anukul. Anukul to bhakti. And we do that. So, these sort of things, they are not substitutes for bhakti. If I start thinking, oh, you know, all that I have to do to improve my relationships is, just, you know, I learn these tips for developing tolerance. Or I learn these tips for, say, public speaking or whatever, for influential speaking. That is not going to work. But, while we are in a devotee community and we have to work with others, if certain things can help us in minimizing conflict or maximizing our productivity, then we can see it as anukul to bhakti. and we can use that in our practice of bhakti. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So, should we stop or it's almost 3:45 now? Yeah, one last question and we'll take a break, then we'll have a short session after that. It's cool.
In the seventh canto, Bhava Maharaj prayed to Lord Shrimati that please appear in our hearts and like, get rid of these material desires. So that's like he actually prayed directly. And that's so if you can explain that a little more, because he's asking to get rid of these material desires, so it's not that he's just like putting it aside and directly asking to give strength and get rid of these desires.
So the question is that is this not pure devotion, or what is the question?
Can you explain that a little more? That if we're talking about you may have material desires or you may have contamination, so then you're not suggesting that we just suppress that, but. Here, a pure devotee like Prahlad Maharaj is directly asking. It's like a valid example of what you were saying. That directly asking to appear in our hearts and get rid of these desires. So,
So Prahlad Maharaj asks, I think that prayer is in the fifth canto, fifth canto, where he says, that please, O Lord, appear in my heart and rip apart my material desires. Yeah, that one. So, how do we understand this prayer? Yes, actually.
What's the question?
Yeah, the question is that Prahlad Maharaj is asking for the Lord to appear in the heart and remove the material desires. So he is basically here stating that he's asking the Lord for something for himself, isn't it? Please remove my desires. He is. So what is your question? Means why is he asking like this?
If you can explain why is he asking like this.
Okay, why is he asking that the material desires be removed? See, material desires are obstacles in the path of bhakti. So he's asking for them to be removed so that he can serve Krishna better. So his devotees, as I said, that if the desires are there in our heart, now if you want to see Prahlad Maharaj as a pure devotee, he has no desires, then we see that as he's just setting an example for us. But even if we're setting an example, what we see is that there are desires within our heart and we want to get rid of them. So that is something which is, because it is anukool to bhakti, so it is also a limb of bhakti. So when we say that, oh Lord, please free me from lust, or please be free from greed, please free me from greed, please free me from anger. No, that is, if we are asking it so that, I can portray to the world, how self-controlled I am, how pure I am, then that is not favorable. But if you're thinking that, when I want to serve Krishna, the lust, the anger, the greed, they interrupt me in my service. They obstruct my service. Therefore, I want to be free from these so that I can serve you better. So then that is very much favorable. So that means we are identifying the obstacles, that this is the obstacle for my practice of bhakti, and I'm praying to Krishna to remove that. Even in astrology, that principle is there that at one level, it is said, you can just depend on Krishna, pray to Krishna, and Krishna takes care of things. But if you can't do that, if there are too many problems in our life, and then some astrologer tells us, you have this graha issue or that graha issue, then it is said that rather than going to a mundane astrologer who will tell us to do some worship of the devatas, some devotee astrologer may tell us to worship some specific manifestations of the Lord for dealing with specific issues. So that is also within the limb of bhakti. We see from 12.8 to 12, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives various levels. Always think of me. If you can't think of me, then strive to think of me. If you can't do that, then just work for me. If you can't work for me, give in charity to me. Like that, he gives various levels. So the highest level we could say is just, Krishna, just absorb. I want to just sing your glories. I want to absorb myself in you. But he said, these are the obstacles for me in doing that. So please remove these obstacles. That is also a prayer which is in the realm of advanced devotion. Does that address your question? Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Yeah, so we will start at 4 o'clock.
Yes, ma'am. What I was suggesting was.